Today on New Horizons, an encore interview with history professor Charles O'Dall talking about the ancient origins of Christmas.
A legend arose that Christ's crown of thorns was made of holly, which does grow in the Holy Land, as well as mistletoe, which was supposedly a plant of peace and related to Christ's title as the Prince of Peace. The festival of December 6th in honor of St. Nicholas gradually was synchronized with Christianity, and he became this jolly figure who inspires us to give gifts to children at Christmas time.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. Christmas is just around the corner, and with it comes many cherished traditions, from decorating the Christmas tree and hanging holly wreaths to burning the Yule log, singing carols, and baking Grandma's favorite cookies. My guest, history professor Charles O'Dall, knows a great deal about the ancient origins of some of those time-honored traditions. A few years ago, I interviewed Dr. O'Dall about this fascinating subject on New Horizons, and today we're featuring an encore edition of that interview. Dr. O'Dall is now in his 34th year of teaching at Boise State. Since this interview first aired, Dr. O'Dall's new book, Constantine and the Christian Empire, has been published. Constantine is now available in paperback and as an e-book on the Internet. Dr. O'Dall's new book, Cicero and the Catilinarian Conspiracy, will be published in 2009. Charles O'Dall, Merry Christmas and welcome to New Horizons.
Felix Nativitas Christi to you, the ancient Latin version of Merry Christmas.
All right. As I was telling you before the show, I was a Latin veteran long ago in my educational preparation, so I hear you. I don't know whether I could speak it very well today, but in any event, why don't we just start with the basics? Where did Christmas come from?
Unlike Easter, which Christians celebrated from the very first century, Christmas did not start until the fourth century. It came about as an offshoot of the Christianization of the Roman Empire by the Emperor Constantine the Great, helped by his mother, St. Helena. Constantine converted to Christianity in 312. He had had a vision on the road to Rome that if he used the name and cross of Christ on his war implements, he would be able to overthrow an evil usurper who had taken the capital city. And he was successful at the Battle of the Mulvian Bridge. He thereafter gave up his worship of the pagan gods and became a devoted Christian for the next 25 years of his reign until his death in 337. So what he was trying to do in those 25 years was to gradually transform the Roman Empire into a Christian commonwealth. He did this by making Sunday a legal holiday, by giving tax breaks to the clergy, by building great Christian churches over the sites of martyrs in Rome, in Constantinople, in Jerusalem. Now, Christmas came as an offshoot of that. His mother had gone on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land in the 320s. With permission from her son, she was using the lucre of the empire, and these were distributed around the Holy Land while she was building the Church of the Holy Sepulchre over the place where Christ had been entombed, the Church of the Ascension, where he had supposedly risen from the Mount of Olives to heaven, and then at Bethlehem, over a little cave that Christians had preserved since the first century, where they knew that the baby Jesus had been born, because they used caves as mangers at that time. And it's interesting that the year after that church was dedicated in 335, the first Mass for the Nativity of Christ, a Christ Mass, Christmas, if you will, was held in Rome. So it was out of the Christianization of the Roman Empire that Christmas began, and only in the fourth century.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a celebration at the end of the year, or at least at that point in the year when the days grew so short. This is what I've heard or read over the years, and you tell me how close I am or how far away. The days were getting shorter. The pagans were getting nervous. What did this mean for their futures, for their livelihood? So at the moment when they saw this turn around and they saw a bit more light in the day, then they started celebrating. and it was a winter festival of some kind. And maybe that made the emperor's job a little easier by the time the 4th century came along? What kind of a grade do I get on that answer?
You're absolutely right. there were two overlapping pagan winter festivals. One was for Saturn. It was called the Saturnalia, and it was held between December 17th and the 24th. And then there was the solar solstice in honor of Sol between December 21st and the 25th. Now, the first one was to honor Saturn as the god of agrarian productivity. The latter was to honor Sol as the light of the world, who brought light to us. And of course, at the solstice, as you just hinted, you have the shortest day of the year, but thereafter you begin to get the days longer. It was one thing for Constantine and the bishops to gradually outlaw the pagan gods and turn the people to Christianity. It was another thing entirely to get rid of the popular pagan festivals through the course of the year. The Saturnalia and the solar festivals were extremely popular in December. I mean, you can see why even today. I mean, we're in the dark of winter, as you indicated.
Right.
It's nice for people to get together and share gifts and have feasts and have warm gatherings and happy times. And that's basically what those pagan winter festivals were all about. So what the Bishop of Rome, his name was Bishop Mark, who was a longtime friend of the Emperor Constantine, wanted to do in 336, was to plug Christian content into the pagan winter festivals and thus turn them in to a deliberately created Christian festival to replace the pagan festivals. People often say Christmas began as a pagan festival. Not in reality. It was begun deliberately to plug Christian content into the pagan winter festivals. And here's how it was done. Wreaths, green wreaths, were put on the doors in honor of Saturn as a god of agrarian productivity. Candles were lit in the houses in honor of Sol as the god of light. The people got together to have their feasts in honor of both of those gods and to give gifts to one another at that time. Now, there were points of contact with all of those elements in Christianity. For instance, the Gospel of John says, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and all things were created through Him." So you could worship Christ as the creative force of the universe who gives and sustains life and put a green wreath in His honor on the doors. The Old Testament had predicted the Messiah to be the Son, S-U-N, of righteousness. And, of course, the New Testament talks about Jesus as the light of the world who comes into the darkness and cannot be overpowered by it. So you could light candles in honor of Christ. And according to the Gospel of Matthew, you had three wise men following the great star coming to the place where Jesus was born and giving him gifts. And, of course, Christianity's ethic was love. The Latin word for that is caritas, charity. And so Christians could give gifts in honor of baby Jesus, in honor of the pagan gods. And by the way, I might mention that I've talked to several astronomers, and there was a convergence of three great planets just about the time that Jesus was born, which actually was around 4 BC. So we know that there was a light that the Magi were coming to. So you take the pagan winter festivals, you plug Christian content into them, and you create a Christian winter festival to replace the pagan winter festivals.
Now, what were the Christians doing to acknowledge, if not celebrate, the birth of Christ between the time he was born and the mid-4th century?
Absolutely nothing.
Zip zero.
This is what is interesting. From the very beginning, they celebrated Good Friday and Easter as the time that Jesus died for our sins to save us from those sins and to celebrate his resurrection to prove that he was the Messiah. And they celebrated 50 days later the Pentecost festival, which was the coming down of the Holy Spirit on the apostles and inspiring them to go out and preach. But they never had done anything on the birth of Jesus. They were concerned more with him as an agent from God, as an adult teacher. And it was only when Constantine's mother went to the Holy Land, went around following the footsteps of Christ, giving out the coins to the common people, building churches at key places, that brought holy sites in the Holy Land to the attention of the Roman populace. In fact, some of my Latin students in class are able to translate the first accounts of pilgrims coming from the West to the East just after St. Helena's pilgrimage, and talking about how beautiful those churches were that she built in Bethlehem and in Jerusalem and on the Mount of Olives. And so it was accounts of these magnificent churches that brought attention to the Holy Land and brought attention to the Nativity of Jesus, something the Christians had not celebrated before.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't the Council of Nicaea, which set up so many of the fundamental beliefs of the church, the doctrine of the church, wasn't that in this period, the 300 and something?
Yes, it was. It was held in June of 325, and it did, along with the emperor and about 300 bishops, define definitively for the church and, in fact, the empire, the official creed of belief that states that Jesus the Christ was both fully God and fully man.
The Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed, which is said still in all mainline Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant denominations, usually every Sunday or at least every fourth Sunday. Mm-hmm. They wanted to emphasize those two things, that the Word of God had become man. You can't have Christ being only God, or you can't have him being only man. And the Nicene Creed defined both of those very clearly. He has to be man so he can suffer and die for our sins. He's got to be God so that he can save us. And it was that emphasis on the humanity in the Nicene Creed that was very important, because that got people thinking about, you know, just where did he walk? Just where did he teach? What was he doing? And there happened to be a wonderful church historian who participated in the Council of Nicaea, named Eusebius of Caesarea, who had just written a history of the church. He actually completed it just before the Council of Nicaea. And it picked up where Luke left off in the book of Acts, you know, around the 60s AD, and brought the story of early Christianity up to Constantine's conversion. And so it emphasized, you know, the human things that had been done, first by Jesus, then by the apostles, and how the church had become a part of the world. That emphasis on the humanity of Jesus made people want to celebrate when he came to earth. There's also a side issue to that. As they started getting rid of the female pagan deities, Venus and Minerva and the others, a lot of people still wanted to have some kind of female figure to worship. And so you begin to get the emphasis upon the Virgin Mary in the 4th and 5th centuries. It's at that time that she becomes the intercessor for her son. It's at that time that she gets the title Mother of God and God-bearer. And we have ancient church mosaics across the Mediterranean that I've studied that show Jesus crowning Mary as Queen of Heaven. Having a special festival in honor of the birth of Christ also emphasized Mary as well as the humanity of Jesus. It's a fact that in Rome, the great Santa Maria Maggiore up in the northern part of the city was built at this period, and that's where they originally held the Christmas Eve midnight masses. It's only been in modern times that they've moved them over to St. Mm-hmm. Peter's.
Now, was the Virgin Mary part of the Catholic doctrine from the very beginning, or was this, again, something that developed in this period of Constantine's power?
They didn't emphasize the doctrine of perpetual virginity in the early church. In fact, in one of St. Paul's letters, it's made very clear that Jesus has brothers and sisters, that James was his brother in the flesh. It's interesting that just this year we found the burial box of James, for instance. It's one of the big finds in Jerusalem. It was only in the 4th and 5th centuries that they began to talk about perpetual virginity of Mary and to talk about the brothers and sisters of Jesus as being children from an earlier marriage of Joseph. So, and we know that's not correct.
Now, gift-giving that we're also accustomed to these days in Christmas celebrations also goes over to Constantine in the sense that he, again, was trying apparently to make the linkage to the wise men. Is that the connection?
From the very beginning, the ethic of Christianity was love. When the Pharisees asked Jesus in Jerusalem, what is the most important commandment of the law? He said, love God and love humanity. All of the law, all of the prophets hangs on love. Now in Greek it was agape, which translates into Latin as caritas, from which we get charity. And so they're not talking about sensual love. They're not talking about friendship love. They're talking about unconditional love that is giving, like we give to the Salvation Army today and so on. And from the very beginning of Christianity, they had on Sunday night the potluck supper, where they would take care of the poor and they would provide them with food. And from the very beginning of the early church, they were not only praising the Lord, they were passing the plate. And what they got from that, they used to take care of the poor members of their community through charitable works. So the idea of charity, of giving to your fellow Christians, was very important. And that could be transferred from the pagan festivals to Christianity, as we talked about earlier, by using the Magi as the witness for that. If the Magi gave gifts to baby Jesus, why don't we give gifts to one another in the same way during the Christmas festival?
Right. Well, let's keep right on moving through the Christmas celebration. Santa Claus. Most of us do understand, of course, that St. Nicholas had something to do with this, but fill us in.
He absolutely did. There was a fellow named St. Nicholas who lived on what would be the southern coast of Turkey today, ancient Asia Minor, a little town called Myra, M-Y-R-A. He probably attended the Council of Nicaea. We're not absolutely sure about that, but we know he was a contemporary with Constantine. He was famous for providing food and shelter for sailors who came into his town, for providing dowries to young maidens of poor families. Unfortunately, in those days, let's face it, clear up until the beginning of the 20th century, to get married, you had to have a dowry to bring from your family to your husband's family. And in antiquity, if your family was so poor that you didn't have that, sometimes the girls would have to go into prostitution or things like that. Now, Nicholas, the Bishop of Myra, made sure that that didn't happen in his town by taking the charity of his church and giving dowries to young maidens, as well as giving gifts to the sailors who came into town. Now, it just so happened that his birthday was December 6th, and after he died sometime in the middle of the 4th century, a festival was started in his honor in the Eastern Mediterranean on December 6th, and it gradually spread to the West in the early Middle Ages. In fact, crusaders in the medieval period, we're talking about the 11th century, went and stole his bones from Turkey and brought it to Italy, where his bones are now in a church of St. Nicholas in southern Italy. And so the festival of December 6th, in honor of St. Nicholas as the patron saint of gift-giving, gradually was synchronized with Christianity. And he became this jolly figure who inspires us to give gifts to children at Christmas time.
Now, he had a name that was close enough to Santa Claus that apparently it was anglicized over the years.
Yeah, when it spread gradually up to the north, it became Sinterklaas in the Netherlands, which is the Dutch. And of course, the Dutch came over and colonized New York before the English did. And so he was Sinterklaas originally in Eastern America. And then when the English took it over from the Dutch, they translated it to Santa Claus. So the modern name Santa Claus goes back from English through Dutch to the original Latin and Greek versions of his name. We still sometimes call him St. Nick, though.
Right, exactly. It took some 19th century poems and articles and paintings to put the finishing touches on this guy we call Santa Claus today.
Absolutely right. Clement Moore, in 1823, wrote 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, and he's the first one who depicted him as the kind of twinkly-eyed, white-haired Santa smoking his pipe. It was printed in Harper's Weekly, which was, of course, a very famous magazine at that time. He really got the final touches in 1863 during the Civil War when Thomas Nast began to make cartoons of him. And it's only then that we see him as this fat, heavily bearded character with the boots and so on. And part of that also comes from Scandinavian Germany. I mean, in antiquity, he would have worn something like the Roman toga. And most of the bishops of the 4th century, in fact, weren't bearded. But by the time you got to the Middle Ages, it became common to wear beards among the clergy. And when his legend spread up to the north, that is Germany and Scandinavia in the Middle Ages, they began to see him as this kind of bearded figure wearing the red symbolic robes that the clergy wore. And so our modern Santa Claus is kind of a composite of ancient, medieval, and modern times.
Exactly. What about holly and mistletoe?
A legend arose that Christ crown of thorns was made of holly, which does grow in the Holy Land. And thus it became something that you would deck your house with, as well as mistletoe, which was supposedly a plant of peace and related to Christ's title as the Prince of Peace.
Well, that's certainly been changed a bit in terms of its significance. I guess you could call it a sign of peace, but a sign of love would probably be a little more accurate since people kiss under the mistletoe these days.
And that's interesting because in the early church, they had what was called the kiss of peace. When you broke from the first half of the service that was basically readings from the scriptures and singing of psalms and so on, to the second half, which was the sharing of the bread and wine, the communion, you would literally kiss one another on the cheek. Now, that's what gives rise to the modern European tradition. We see men kissing each other on the cheek that we just don't do in America. Today, you know, in the church services, in the fellowship period, you will shake hands or something like that, or or maybe do a hug. So the kiss of peace really does go back to the early church.
Right. Now, we know that the artificial Christmas tree comes from Lowe's or Home Depot. What about the real Christmas tree? Where did this idea of celebrating Christmas with a real tree you'd cut down and bring into your home? I mean, if you stop and take away all of our sensibilities about Christmas, it is a rather absurd proposition, I must say. But, of course, it happened, and it happened, and it goes way back, and please tell us.
It's an extension of the green wreaths that started in the 4th century. But Christmas trees technically were not added until the 8th century. The popes were sending missionaries up to the Germans who were across the Rhine and had never been in the Christian Roman Empire of antiquity, and ultimately up to the Scandinavians. The Germans and the Scandinavians worshipped their Teutonic gods, and among them was Odin. And they believed that Odin's powers were somehow represented by a great fir tree up in the forests of Germany, and they would gather for their pagan worship services around a fir tree. St. Boniface, a missionary in 750, went up to Germany, and he wanted to prove to the Germans that Odin had no power, that he was a fake deity, he didn't exist at all. So he took a big axe and he cut down their favorite fir tree, proved that Odin had no power. And he said, if you still want to worship around firs, why don't you take little trees into your house and put candles on them and worship baby Jesus at Christmas time? So the Christmas tree tradition started in Germany and then gradually spread through Europe. Here's an interesting side note to that. Christmas trees were not used at the Vatican, you know, where the first Christmas was held in 336 AD until 1978. My good friend Pope John Paul II, whom I've had two audiences with, is the one who brought that tradition from Northern Europe, from his homeland, Poland, down to the Vatican in 1978 when he became Pope, you know, our longest ruled modern Pope now for 25 years.
Wait a minute,
1978. Italians had it, but they had never used Christmas trees or even manger scenes in the Vatican until 1978. And now, every year, right now, they are putting up a big Christmas tree like we are doing at the President's house, the White House
in
Washington.
Yeah, but it's not from
Idaho. No, unfortunately, it's not quite as nice. And they're also putting up a manger scene out in front of St. Peter's Cathedral. But these will not be lighted until 10 p.m. Christmas Eve because the Europeans celebrate Christmas differently than we do. You know, we start celebrating Christmas in the summertime. They have the traditional 12 days of Christmas. They light the Christmas tree. They unshroud the manger scene in front of St. Peter's Cathedral as people are going in for the Christmas Eve midnight mass. And I got to participate in that in 1974 after I had written a book on early Christian Latin that the Pope liked. It's quite interesting that you then have the 12 days of Christmas from Christmas Day to January 6th, which is called Epiphany, supposedly when the wise men had come. And so we get that song about the gifts that you give each day of the 12 days of Christmas.
Right. Well, you may have just helped me understand something I never understood in my own family. I had an aunt and uncle who never put their tree up until Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
I never could figure that out.
It's a European tradition.
That's a European tradition.
Bet. Yeah, and then you can sing the 12 days of Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, nativity scenes. I was really surprised to see in your writing that nativity scenes didn't come around until the 12th, 13th century?
That's right. Yeah. Right. St. Francis of Assisi, the famous saint who loved nature and wrote that beautiful poem, Brother Sun, Sister Moon, you know, that celebrates all nature singing in honor of God. He's the one who first did it in central Italy, north central Italy, in 1223, because he wanted to show the animals and all of nature,
of course,
coming to the manger scene and worshiping baby Jesus. And so that's something that started fairly late in terms of Christmas traditions, and it's gradually spread to the whole world.
Do you think he had any evidence from past writings, the Gospels, that allowed him to recreate the nativity scene, or is the nativity scene as we bring it out every year at Christmas basically St. Francis of Assisi's idea of who was there as opposed to what we might find in the Gospels, thinking about the animals and all of the, the shepherds and I mean that some of that of course is in the is in the Gospels. A lot of that is in the Gospels.
Now the earliest Gospel, Mark, only starts with Jesus' baptism, as does the last and longest Gospel, John. But Matthew and Luke, they did talk about the birth of Jesus at Bethlehem, and particularly Luke gives the most detailed account of the shepherds coming in and singing. So St. Francis was working primarily from the Gospel of Luke and what it tells us. We've kind of got the mistaken idea that a manger is kind of like a barn out in a farm in Parma or something like that, you know. But in reality, they actually kept their animals in these caves at the little top of the hilltop town of Bethlehem, which still has a number of caves there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, St. Helena's Church is focused upon the cave where supposedly Jesus was born and where the manger was located.
Well, to move from the sublime to the ridiculous, one could argue, let's close by just a mention of Christmas cards and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Where did they come from?
Christmas cards didn't start until the 19th century, and Rudolph until the 20th century. Christmas cards were developed by a guy named John C. Horsley in England in 1843. Actually, he painted little cards that he sent to his friends. And then they started mass producing them in the 1870s. And so the tradition of sending greetings to one another is really only about 135 years old. Now, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is the last thing of all. It was a story written in 1939 by Robert L. May as a Montgomery Ward Christmas book, you know, which is kind of like modern Christmas, where you're trying to sell things.
Right.
So they wanted to write this wonderful little story about this red-nosed reindeer, and it was made popular by a song written by Johnny Marks and sung by Gene Autry in 1949. So that's almost the last aspect of modern Christmas traditions, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Of course, that all goes back to the Scandinavian versions of Christmas, because you don't have the reindeers where St. Nicholas started in Turkey.
Exactly. I guess if you want to take it right up to really modern times, you could say that some of these productions, these TV productions that are classics every year that come back on Rudolph and Frosty and all these folks, they, in a sense, continue the tradition and build on it and embellish it, I'm sure, in many ways.
We keep adding to it, you know, which is nice.
Well, Dr. Charles O'Dall, this has been really delightful and fascinating and so perfectly timed with the Christmas season. Thank you for joining us on New Horizons.
It's been a pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this interview with Charles O'Dall. Next week, an encore interview with Bob Olson, tour guide at Idaho's historic Old Penn. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research provided by Kathleen Craven. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who helped shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.